listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 531.
Hello and welcome back to another podcast here on The Outdoor Station. I'm Bob Cartwright and The Outdoor Station is the longest running outdoors podcast in the world. We started in 2005 and we've over 500 podcasts available in the library for your enjoyment. This is part two with my interview with Ben Montgomery, the author of Grandma Gatewood's biography. In part one, we heard more about her backstory, her younger life and married life, and what led her to ultimately start the trail. And now we get into the nitty-gritty of her travelling life, the people she met along the way, and some of the unique stories that go to make up this colourful character. More details, and of course the complete story, can be found in Ben's book, Grandma Gatewood's Walk, available in Amazon and all good bookstores. So let's talk about a couple of incidences on the trail itself then, to bring it alive, and then to go on to some of the other historical things that were taking place at the time, which obviously refers to the hurricanes. There's a couple of nice stories, the of her crossing a river and sleeping with some boys from Harlem. But I just want to preempt that if I could. There's something else you mentioned in your book, and I've gathered a few of the notes together, but I just wanted to emphasize again, just to comment on her character. She was a very straight-laced sort of woman. She was a proper woman. I think you, the word you used in a sentence in your book was she was a white gloves sort of woman. And I've known elderly relatives that are like that. There's a right way of doing things, and there's a right way to behave, and there's a correct way that boys and girls should meet, and whatever. And in fact, I'm jumping ahead now, but towards the end of the book, I think there was, when she was in her 70s, a gentleman offered to go walking with her for a few days, and she didn't accept him because it wasn't going to be proper in her 70s. I thought it was epic. But anyway, I just want to come back to this particular story because you tell it really well from the how she came across this hut full of boys from Harlem.
Yeah, well, you know, as if walking 2,000 miles through the Appalachian wilderness wasn't difficult enough, there were two weather events that really impacted that region in 1955, in the summer of 55. And I think it was starting in early July. Oh, yeah, we're in August, I guess. So Hurricanes Connie and Diane both blew in back to back and kind of took, they weren't the same path, but kind of took relatively, they both made landfall in relatively the same place in the U.S. And both wreaked havoc on the mid-Appalachian region and also on New York and New England, causing well, at the time, they were the most expensive storms on record in American history. They killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 211 people in New England, caused great amounts of damage. And she was exposed for much of this on the Appalachian Trail. So she had a lot of difficulty both slogging through the water every day, slogging through the wind and rain, occasionally fearing that she would get blown off a mountainside. And if you've never lived through a hurricane, they're you know, pretty common to me since I've lived in Florida since 2005. You know, often Cat 1, Cat 2 hurricanes can bring gusts of wind that can actually blow you down, blow you off your feet. And so if you can imagine being exposed in the outdoor, not just, afraid of widow killers, as we call them, or widow makers, rather, the trees, deadwood trees falling down on you and things like that, just actually being scared of getting blown off a mountain. These are the things that she had to deal with. But she came upon in the Green Mountains of Vermont after slogging through water all day one day. She came upon a shelter, a lean-to, occupied by, as she described, eight, she used the term colored boys from a Catholic parish in Harlem. By that she means eight African-American boys, most likely from a Catholic parish in Harlem. She just describes them kind of as Catholic kids. And she said that when she walked up to the shelter, they were They're very kind. They invited her to partake of their corn pone that they cooked on the fire. She said the boys were a little rambunctious. They were picking apples, unripe apples off the apple trees and throwing them at one another. And they invited her to stay that night, but it looked like the shelter was a little full, a little tight for her to sleep there. She decided to try to go on. But after a couple of hours of hiking, she realized that she couldn't make it further up the trail. She came to a stream that had escaped its bounds. It was at flood stage and she couldn't cross safely on her own. She returned to that shelter and decided to spend the night with those boys. She wrote that she had a nice time. She, you know, had a slightly difficult time falling asleep because the young man next to her, she was curled up in a corner, but the young man next to her, he would throw his arm over her shoulder in his own sleep, and she would move it back and he would throw it back over again and she would move it back. And if you can imagine this, a 67-year-old woman with eight African-American teens and their two white leaders trying to all sleep in the same three-sided shelter. It's just sort of a funny picture, especially when you think about 1954 was the Supreme Court decision that decided Brown versus Board of Education, a famous Supreme Court decision in the U.S. that decided public schooling should be equal for all races, essentially. And what this did was created some outbursts of racial violence. In a picture, that image of Emma sleeping in this shelter with these boys is just kind of beautiful to me. Well, it turns out she wouldn't learn this until later. Maybe actually she, I don't think ever knew, but I pieced this together. It turns out the boys staying in that shelter that day had all come from Harlem, and they weren't exactly Catholic boys. The summer of 1955 in Harlem, which is neighborhood in New York City. It was an especially violent summer. It was hot. There was gang warfare over every square inch of concrete in Harlem. And the violence, the bloodshed got so bad that the Catholic Church saw the need to appoint these two young seminarians to identify the four head honchos of these two rival and warring gangs and offer them an all-expense-paid trip to the Green Mountains of Vermont in order to broker the peace. And so these Catholic boys that Emma Gatewood slept with that night were, in fact, the gang leaders from these two rival gangs in Harlem who were up there trying to figure things out for themselves. As I would later find out, she really came to like these boys and, in fact, rode on the back of one of the young strapping teenagers across that flood stage creek the next morning when they all hiked out together. So this was a unique experience for her and also an interesting experience. I don't think she ever knew who exactly she was staying with. I found that nugget, make a long story short, it was accounted for in a chapter of a book that was written by one of those Catholic priests who had taken the boys out that summer. And remembered meeting Grandma Gatewood on the trail.
And I'm sure that makes a fascinating read as well. But again, you portray it beautifully in the book with the detail. And as you rightly say, Hurricane Connie and Diane really did raise the water levels. There was another couple of characters as well. That was the U.S. naval guys, Howard Bell and Steve Sargent. Now, again, just to remind people where it was, as I understand it, Emma didn't see the sea or saw the sea for the first time in 1926, and she never went in to swim. She couldn't swim. So The hurricanes had raised these creeks some 30 feet or whatever in a very, very short period of time. And there's a horrific story which must go down in American history of one of the campsites where the water raised so quickly that the children got into the camp house and went up each level till eventually they went into the attic and the house collapsed, unfortunately killing a lot of people. So it was pretty treacherous times, really. And obviously the trail itself is nothing like, or was nothing like, the trail as it's seen today. So she did a lot of bashing to get through it. But do tell the story about the two naval guys and their impressions of her.
Yeah, she had stayed the night before at the same shelter these two boys were staying, and they were both 18, 19 years old, on leave from the Navy. And they were just out for, you know, a week of backpacking, hiking, fishing, that sort of thing. They weren't trying to do the whole trail. But Emma had slept with them one night before, and then she woke up before they did the next morning and took off on her own. And when she made it down the trail, she came to a spot called Clarendon Gorge, and the water had risen so rapidly that it so high that it had washed out the pedestrian footbridge that took an AT hiker across the gorge. And so she had no safe way to cross. She walked upstream and downstream and couldn't find, you know, any safe passage. So she knew those boys would be coming behind her, and she thought she'd sit down and wait for them. And sure enough, a couple of hours later, they show up. And in all their youthful wisdom, they decide the best thing they can do is to use parachute cord to tie 5'2" Emma Gatewood in between them, including her pack, to like just tie themselves together so they could all traverse this flood stage creek together. And this is what they did. And, you know, Emma writes in her journal that she had a difficult time with this. Like you said, this was a deadly storm. There's nothing to laugh about. I guess we can laugh all these years later, but all tied together, these three human beings took baby step by baby step all the way across Clarendon Gorge until they made it safely to the other side. And once they did, boy, Emma, you know, grabbed her stuff and she said, "Well, boys, you got Grandma across. Thanks very much." And she kind of took off upstream and left them behind. They never saw her again. She did record their names in her journal, so I was able to track them down. Both of them are still living. One lives down here in Sarasota, Florida, not far from me. And I called him up out of the blue one day. I told him, as I was reporting the book, I told him who I was. And I said, "I think you're the same guy who met a woman named Emma Gatewood on the Appalachian Trail way back in 1955. And he said, "I was." He remembered that experience. And I told him what Emma had written about it. And she kind of addressed it in a funny way. She said, "You know, and then they got me across and I left." I said, "Hey, you got Grandma across," and I took off. And I said, "Do you remember it like that?" And he said, "Ben, I could never forget that because I still to this day have nightmares about it." And he's now in his 80s, right? So this was made a lasting impact on Mr. Sargent. This was, you know, treachery, but she wasn't about to turn back because of a flood level stream. She kept right on going.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, time is marching on, and there's so much to talk about. So, are you okay for time for another half hour or so? This is going great. We're entertaining good 30 plus people as well, which is really good to see. So, I hope everybody's enjoying it. Do by all means drop a note into the chat room. Rose is waiting to help you or reply or comment or whatever. And we'll come on to some questions a bit later on. But a couple of things I wanted to talk about now, really, and it's the start of something you alluded to earlier on. Was, as I understand it, she was 48 days in, 300 miles in, before she received her first newspaper coverage or article or whatever it may be. I mean, she didn't do it for the celebrity status, but this thing started to grow like Topsy. So what I'd like to do is talk a bit about this and how this sort of grew, and then we'll come on to you actually walking in her footsteps on Mount Katahdin as well. On the last day and comparing notes on that. But tell us a bit about her celebrity status and how it started to slowly build.
For sure. And I'm so sorry about that ding. If y'all are hearing that, I thought I had this all shut off, and somehow my computer is betraying me. So I'll just press on.
You're a popular guy. So, you're a popular guy.
Yes. Yeah, so as it turns out, Emma Gatewood thought from the beginning that if people knew about her journey, what she set out to do, that somebody would try to stop her. If not, that she would be hurt or harmed by someone. And the difficulty in that is that without telling anybody, nobody knows where you were. And so her family, her people, her children, 11 of them were alive and, you know, back in Ohio and elsewhere. They didn't know where she was. And there's no indication that she was ever going to tell them until she finished hiking the AT. But she arrived at Roanoke, Virginia, which is, you know, getting close to Midway. And but before anybody ever talked her into telling her story, before any newspaper reporter stopped her so that she might make public what it was she was trying to do. And boy, when they did that, then the word spread like wildfire. Every newspaper reporter in every town from that point north wanted to interview her for the story. But by then, nobody knew where she was. And so much of her family back home actually read it in the newspaper. It had run. I'm going to try to take care of this. I'm so sorry. Is this bothering you guys like it's bothering me? I'm so sorry. I thought I had this taken care of. But I'm somehow on a text thread that's just beeping, beeping, beeping. Give me 1 second. So she presses on from Roanoke, and by then all of America starts to tune into her story. Like I said, every town that she walked through subsequent, there was a newspaper reporter or sometimes a radio reporter, television reporter waiting to tell America about, you know, this 67 year old woman who was trying to through hike the Appalachian Trail. And it didn't wind up being dangerous for her. In fact, I think with more attention focused on what she was doing and more knowledge about who she was, it probably opened the doors to her getting more meals because people knew to expect her because they had read about her in the newspaper and things like that. So it actually was probably more beneficial for her. And then on down the line, you know, this started to grow from not just the small town newspapers, but to major newspapers and major publications. Eventually, at Mount Katahdin, she is intercepted by a reporter from what was at the time a fledgling magazine called Sports Illustrated. And this reporter, Mary Snow, convinced Emma Gatewood to let her share the story, you know, on a grand scale. And this became one of the biggest stories that kind of got her name out there and introduced Americans at large to the Appalachian Trail. But yeah, that had, the guys in Roanoke, Virginia, who worked for the newspaper and were also members of the trail club, they kind of tricked her into sharing her story. She wasn't about to do it at first. And they said, well, let us give you a place to stay at the trail club shelter. And they offered to carry her bag an additional 10 miles or so and meet her further up the trail. And by the time she arrived, her defenses were worn down a little bit. And they eventually got her to late one night, got her to share who she was and what it was she was doing. And that became the impetus for all of this coverage that was to follow, that included not just for the rest of that first hike, but also many, many stories in newspapers on her second hike and her third hike, and then the hike sort of the other direction on the Oregon Trail.
So that's obviously how it started, and as you say, every small town newspaper reporter would know the next one in the next town, of course. And she started to get sort of national recognition, I guess, but she wasn't really aware of this at all, apart from she saw the reporters, but I don't think she was aware of just how big it was becoming at that stage. And again, she wasn't doing it for the celebrity status as many people on Instagram will be doing it these days. But let's just go on to Mount Katahdin and that final day up there. I understand that you, in wanting to be true to the book, actually hired a guide who tracked down her original route, because, as we said, the routes have changed over the years for different reasons. Yeah. And you took your expensive equipment, which you probably spent a small fortune on, getting yourself ready for it. And got yourself onto Katahdin and started to climb and follow the route. So I just really wanted to know, you no doubt read her diary, her journal of that particular day very, very closely in great detail. And then you walked in her footsteps, albeit with modern equipment. How did you feel at that moment? Did you really feel that you were connecting in some special way with her?
That was my effort. You know, I think the last day for her, at least in terms of the importance of the whole trip, the last day for her was just as important as every other day before that. And so she addressed it in her journal the same way. And this was not a person who waxed poetically about what she was experiencing on the trail. She wrote very matter-of-factly, here's where I started, here's where I woke up, this is what I ate, this is where I walked, here's how tired I was. You know, it was that sort of or surface level technical details. So she didn't think of any grand terms about what her hike might have meant, about what that last day climbing Mount Katahdin and becoming the first woman to solo throughout the AT would have meant. It was just another day for her, just another walk. And so I realized as the climax of the book, I needed to kind of make it bigger than the small set of facts that I was working with, right? So I tried to bring myself into it a little bit and tell modern readers what that experience might look like for them. I'm a healthy guy who goes on lots of hikes, and I wanted to describe accurately what that climb, how difficult that climb up Mount Katahdin would have been for me in good weather conditions, so that you could imagine what it might have been for her, you know, hiking through the sleet with a busted knee, one lens broken out of her glasses, and you know, the other one fogging up over and over through the freezing cold. So hopefully that worked to help people understand that this is not an easy hike. This is a challenging climb at the very end of the mountain. It's one of the first places the sun kisses the eastern side of the United States every morning. One of the tallest mountains in Maine at just about a mile high. It is an amazing mountain and one of the most sacred and beautiful places, I think, in all of America. You know, H.D. Thoreau climbed Mount Katahdin, I think, in the 1850s and nearly came undone on his climb. He said, basically, this is no man's land. This is a place where man doesn't have the right to be. We should preserve and protect this. And he wrote that he felt like God was trying to dislodge him from the mountain the whole time he was climbing up it. And so. So it's an important spot. And for me to do that, to walk in her footsteps, you pointed out earlier, a lot of the trail is different today. Someone told me 99% of the trail is actually different today than it was in 1955. And so the only stretch that we knew for sure that was going to be exactly the same was the Hunt Spur up Mount Katahdin. And we used her diaries, gave them to a guy who was the Baxter State Parks superintendent of trails. He used that knowledge and his knowledge of the past in Baxter State Park to bring us up the exact same route she would have walked. And I was just trying to get into her head, you know. And what a neat experience that was, to spend so long studying the life of this impressive, awesome woman who I came to love, and then to step in her footsteps, to follow her footsteps up this historic trail to the top of Mount Katahdin, to see what she saw, became a beautiful thing. And as you know, when she got up there, it was a bit of ceremony, but she was ready to get back down pretty quickly. So she signed the register at the top of Mount Katahdin. She sang the first verse of America the Beautiful. And she said, "I've done it. I said I'd do it and I've done it." And without much pomp or circumstance, she just kind of turned around and walked back down. And then, of course, at the base, she was greeted by all the reporters who were waiting for her to see if she had completed her journey. And it was a moment of celebration.
I understand she was also a victim of fake news as well. She was probably one of the earliest people to have recorded fake news, because CBS News had picked up an incorrect report from one of the small town reporters saying that she was going to do a square dance on the top. And they asked her if she did that or not. So I found that quite amusing. But when you went up there yourself, and you obviously, there was quite a few people up there, you obviously got into conversation with them, and no doubt as part of the research and part of conversation, you mentioned the name. What was the feeling that it gave you when they started to reply back to you, how much they could relate to Grandma Gatewood and how much they knew about her?
I was blown away, because I knew that she enjoyed a certain legacy among people who hiked the Appalachian Trail and those who just love the Appalachian Trail. But I didn't know how widespread it was. And I certainly didn't know that just about everybody standing on top of that mountain would have recognized her name. A lot of these folks, by the way, we did this in September, I think September 25th, 25th or 26th of 2012. And she had finished on the 25th or 26th, forgive my memory for failing on this part, but But we did, you know, we climbed it the same day years and years later. Anyways, we finished the same time that there were a number of through hikers who were finishing, and I didn't want to mess up the sheer joy one gets from fulfilling that mission, from completing that incredible hike that takes, you know, several months. And so I let them have their moment of celebration. I let them take their photos, and I kind of sheepishly approach them afterwards. And I would just ask, hey, do you know about Grandma Gatewood? I'm writing a book about her. Do you have any thoughts or whatever? And to a T, everybody knew who she was, but everyone had different ideas about what she had done. And, you know, I talked to one young man I remember who said, you know, you got to respect anybody who can hike the entire Appalachian Trail barefoot. And it made me think, well, her legacy has grown a little bit. You know, she wore Keds, but she was never barefoot, so far as I know. But that's, you know, so be it. That's how her story has grown. But it was cool. It was, you know, to learn not just from those folks in that experience, but also in the years since, how big of an impact this woman has had, both on people personally and also on the success and survival of the Appalachian Trail, is a pretty cool thing. I don't know of another person who's kind of done more organically, not because she meant to, but organically, who's done more to promote the trail and also to criticize the trail when it needed it, so that folks, it led to better maintenance and better ecological sensitivity and better experience for hikers and things like that. So it was cool to kind of step back and get this bigger picture of who she was and what she meant to this thing that's so beloved and so important to people around the world. And in fact, that time I climbed Mount Katahdin, I saw we had somebody from New Zealand in here. I finished, we were coming down with a woman who appeared to me to be in her 60s and 70s, and she was wearing Teva sandals, and I think she had left her bag at the bottom, and so she was hiking without a backpack, really moving, blowing right past us as we came down the mountain. And I caught up to her and I started a conversation. She was from New Zealand, and she said this was her, she was completing her third through hike of the Appalachian Trail. Mm. And she did so without any ceremony. She had just finished that day and she was on her way back down. And here comes, you know, a stranger. Hey, what are you doing out here? And she was like, yeah, I just finished my third through hike of the Appalachian Trail. And I said, are you going to do it again? She was like, yeah, I'm getting kind of bored with this one. I might go try to do another one. But that's the case anymore. You go on the AT and you meet people from all over the world who have decided that they want to do a through hike and, you know, have set out to do it. It's a very cool thing.
The National Outdoor Expo aims to bring the whole outdoor community together under one roof at the NEC in Birmingham, March 2021. Aimed at walkers, climbers, campers and runners, it's going to be a show full of inspiration, kit, tech, nutrition and advice needed to be more active outside. The Outdoor Station is going to be there too, talking with adventurers and brands galore. Plus, we're giving away 10 free tickets every week until the event to our listeners and viewers who like, comment and share our weekly Random Outdoor Expo posts on Twitter and Instagram. To enter, keep your eye on our social media accounts, and when you see a free ticket posting, like it, comment on it and share it with someone to take with you to the expo. You're limited to one entry per account each week until March, and winners will be chosen at random. Full terms and conditions can be found over on the outdoorstation.co.uk website. The National Outdoor Expo is on the 27th and 28th of March 2021. We'll see you there.
Well, again, time's marching on. There's still plenty to talk about if you're okay for time. One person has asked wondering why she carried her stuff in the bag rather than the backpack like Earl Schaefer did in the photo. And I've got a picture of some of her equipment here. which I think is in the I'll get the word out in a second. The ATC. So perhaps you could quickly just run through what she did take, and she took it on subsequent hikes as well. And before we get into the next stage of the legacy, really.
Yeah. She brought along, I mean, what we know, and by the way, she never, the part of what's so interesting to me is I'm always making adjustments in my gear, right? If your backpack doesn't fit or is like slightly uncomfortable, well, you might save up and get another backpack or adjust the straps or what have you. If you're bringing the wrong kind of food, which I did, I took my kids 2 summers ago to do a 260-mile stretch on the AT, and I just brought food that they didn't want to eat. I was trying to save some money, and I dehydrated a lot of stuff myself, and it turns out it didn't taste nearly as good as the backpacker, you know, the store-bought backpack meals. Anyways, she never changed her gear. She basically brought the same exact stuff for all three through hikes, and by and large for most of the hike on the Oregon Trail. And it included this denim drawstring sack that was, you know, fairly sizable, would hold some gear. She brought along that tin that you see there pictured. It was a Band-Aid tin, and it had in it some meager supplies. She brought some Vic salve. She brought a couple of Band-Aids, some bobby pins to keep her hair out of her face. She wore canvas sneakers most of the time, Keds, sometimes Chuck Taylors, Converse, regular athletic socks, men's dungarees, like you mentioned, the gingham dress, which she could shake out in the event she had to walk through a town or something. She brought no tent, no sleeping bag. She brought a shower curtain to keep the rain off. So, you know, if you can imagine hiking through 2 back-to-back hurricanes with a shower curtain, that's your only protection from the rain. And she didn't adjust. You know, it wasn't like in 1957 she decided, oh, I'll bring a tent this time. She just brought the same gear. So it's a curious selection of stuff, but it was very light. And it ranged anywhere from about, I think at its lightest, her pack maybe weighed about 15 pounds, and its heaviest, it maybe weighed about 30 pounds. So she, you know, very, very much fit the ID of a lightweight pioneer, even though we weren't even talking about lightweight hiking. Yeah, we were calling it ultralight hiking, certainly at that time. She just brought what she needed. And then if she didn't have something, she, you know, either did without or found a way to get around it, to ad lib.
Sure.
One time she found a fork at a campfire that somebody had discarded, and she was like, oh, this will make a fine comb. And she used the fork to comb out her hair. And actually, that makes sense. If I had hair, I'd probably comb it with the fork.
Yeah. Well, you and I both use polish, obviously. That's the only way to go. The couple of things that did strike me when I did look through the details was that she obviously lit a fire on a regular basis, either to dry her clothes out. She lit a fire to heat rocks, and she slept on warm rocks. I know that the sack, she emptied a sack out a few times and filled it full of leaves, and she used that as a mattress to sleep on. And then she slept in all the huts and all the various places that she could find earlier on, or find as she went along, rather. But the one thing that occurred to me, did she take any fire lighting equipment? Because obviously the matches wouldn't have lasted very long in the weather that she was going through. So were you aware of her having any technique for lighting a fire? She'd obviously be very good at it anyway, but I mean, I just wondered if there was anything that came to mind.
Yeah, no, I don't. I have no idea. You know, everything that I know about her gear, she never mentioned any fire starting devices, but you're right. She did a lot of times. It seems like I recall her saying her matches were wet a few times. So maybe she was just resupplying with the matches occasionally and carrying them in that little tin full of Band-Aids. But it's a fine question. I'm not 100% sure on that. It may be lost to history, unfortunately.
It's one of those things these days, everybody goes on about different ways to light fires. And I was just curious, as she's one of the original old timers, what she used. But anyway, we've kept people's attention so far, and we're going to go on to now the effect and the legacy that she left. But we'll start by looking at her celebrity status as it started to build. And obviously, she was getting a lot of press coverage. And she did it a second time 2 years later, I think it was. And then she went on to do the Oregon Trail. And the celebrity status just went through the roof. And perhaps you'd just like to eloquently describe how she arrived in Portland and really what her status consisted of by the time she got to that stage. And we'll, as you're doing so, I'll just flip through some of the press things here.
Sure. Yeah. So as I mentioned, starting in Roanoke, Virginia, with that first newspaper story, the word just spread immensely. One of the photos that you've got on the screen now is from is the one on the on my right is the a story from Sports Illustrated magazine. It became the case where, like I said, where people would read about her in the newspaper and then go out looking for her. Certainly, as she hiked the Oregon Trail, which also runs about 2,000 miles from Independence, Missouri, to Portland, Oregon. She was doing a lot of walking on the shoulder of the highway. And so word had spread that she was hiking the Oregon Trail, and people would go out and search for her, or be driving down the highway and having read about her in the newspaper, they'd pull over and stop and they'd want to take photos of her or get an autograph and things like that. But by the time she arrived in Portland, and this was in the year 1959, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 people waiting for her to celebrate her arrival in town, having walked the entire Oregon Trail in about 90 days. So she made it into Oregon. She was treated like a celebrity. The mayor greeted her upon her reaching the city center. They took her up in a helicopter. They took her out on a yacht off the west coast of the U.S. They put her up at the Benson Hotel, which is a very nice hotel in the day and even today. Somebody told me not long ago that they even kept some of her gear, including the umbrella that she's photographed with there, at the Portland Museum of History, which I tried to figure out if that's true or not, and I couldn't find anybody who could say whether they had any of that stuff. But they certainly celebrated her arrival, and from then on, you know, she enjoyed a level of celebrity that she'd not ever experienced, probably never expected to experience before that. She made it onto a television program that is now, you know, it'd be equal to like Good Morning America. This was the Dave Garraway show, or the Today Show with Dave Garraway. She got on the a show called You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx, which was filmed out west in Hollywood. People were you know, they loved her. She became a sort of a mascot, if you will, for, you know, for elderly hikers. And she never drove a car. She never even had a driver's license. And so anytime she wanted to go somewhere, even up in years like these photos, she would just strap on her shoes and take a walk. And that sometimes meant walking to visit her daughter in Pennsylvania. She would walk from her hometown in Ohio up to Pennsylvania, 280 miles to visit Ken. She once walked to a national meeting of the the National Hikers and Campers Association, Campers and Hikers Association. It was nothing for her to just set out on foot. And she, starting at the age of 67, by my calculation, she accumulated about 14,000 miles on foot between 1955, when she started the AT, and 1973, when she finally died, which is an incredible accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll start to wind up a bit now. I think the final thing I wanted to just show people was the memorial, the historical marker that's to her there. And I understand that she had there is a trail, the Grandma Greatwood Memorial Trail, which is a bit like a rock concert from your description, I believe, of the popularity of thousands of people arriving to do a particular 6.5 mile walk on a certain day. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a very popular trail, and that hike, which happens every January, called the Winter Hike, which she led for years and years, remains a very popular hike. I went a few years ago, and the official count was somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 people had shown up on this one Saturday to take a hike. And forgive me for not talking more about her legacy before, but just since the book has come out, they've erected that historical marker in her hometown of Cheshire, Ohio. The New York Times, which is a venerable newspaper here in the U.S., the paper of record for us, saw fit to do a news obituary about a year and a half ago, as a part of a series they're doing called Overlooked, where they didn't give proper news obituaries to women and others who had made significant contributions to American society. And so years after her death, she finally got an obit in the New York Times, which was a pretty cool thing. And her family was certainly happy to see that. But her legacy also lives in, in a million other ways. She was a member of the second class of entrance into the Appalachian Hall of Fame. The second class of Appalachian Hikers Hall of Fame. Anywhere you go on the AT today, Grandma Gatewood and her story are never far away. I can, spend a day on the trail and bump into two or three people that want to talk about Grandma Gatewood. It's just a good story that everybody can celebrate and everybody likes. She was a character with few blemishes, I think, and she did so much for the trail and so much to preserve the history of the trail and also to encourage people who are in their golden years to get out of doors, and that it's not. Too much. If you're 67 or 77 or 87, it's rarely too much to, take a 2,000-mile walk if you have what it takes in terms of ambition and heart. And that's what she left us all. This idea that, it's more heart than head. You just put one foot in front of the other about 5 million times and you too can walk 2,000 miles through the wilderness.
I think one of the quotes in your book, she said something about, a 2,000 mile trail, after the life I've lived, a 2,000 mile trail is nothing. So I thought, full respect to her, really, a great character. So anyway, folks, I'm going to just let you know about what's coming next Wednesday, another interview with another author. And while this is playing, do drop down any questions you have for Ben. I can see there's still a good 30 or so people watching. So do drop any questions, anything else you want to add. And then we'll come on to Ben's books. There are a series of a couple of other books I just quickly want to talk about. And we'll then start to wrap it up. So this is what's coming next week.
On Wednesday, the 25th of November, I'm going to be talking with mountaineer, climber and editor Alex Roddy regarding the gorgeous new coffee table book, Wanderlust Europe, The Great European Hike, published by Gestaltin Books. From the temperate climes of the Spanish islands, over the Nordic fjords and to the summit of Alpine peaks, Wanderlust Europe points the reader in the direction of the continent's most awe-inspiring routes. This is a stimulating manual for hikers of all skill levels in pursuit of breathtaking beauty and a sense of freedom. I'll also have a copy to give away on the night, but you must be watching to win it. So join me and Alex on the Outdoors Station YouTube channel at 7 p.m. Wednesday the 25th of November, to hear more stories about these fabulous routes.
So that's what's coming next Wednesday. So join us again at same time, 7 o'clock, all being well next Wednesday. And questions, there haven't been many questions coming through at the moment, which is fine. So what we'll do is we'll have a look at some of Ben's other books, which I'm sure he can tell us a bit about. Now, he's obviously getting a reputation for books with great backstories and just like Grandma Gatewood's. So tell us a few things about a few of the other books that can be found, and Rose will drop the links into the chat room for everybody.
Sure. So The Man Who Walked Backward is a story of a guy named Plenty Wingo, who is a Texan who decided in 1931 on the front end of the Great Depression that he would try to walk backward around the world. And it's a fun rollick through Depression era America and Europe. The Leper Spy is about a woman who was a spy for the U.S. during World War II, and she was good because she had leprosy. And the Japanese, during their occupation of her home city of Manila, were afraid culturally, horribly afraid of contracting contagious disease, and so she was able to do these really intrepid and life-saving spy missions because she was suffering from a disease. And then lastly, the book that comes out January 25th, coming right up, A Shot in the Moonlight. It tells the story of a man named George Denning, who was born into slavery in southwestern Kentucky, and eventually defends himself from attack from a lynch mob that had showed up at his house one night in 1897 to try to chase him and his family off. And he killed one of the would-be lynchers and was convicted for that, and then pardoned by the governor for that, and then sued the lynch mob in court in a very sensational case that has been largely forgotten in American history, where a black man was successfully sued for damages, a lynch mob that had tried to kill him.
Sounds really good. I think we've got one question that's come through. I've lost it. Where is it now? It was about the hydration. Here we go. From Dave Fowler. I'd love to know what Emma did about hydration. I guess water sources were safer then, but did she carry any water in any way, or was it fresh flowing water commonly available?
Yeah, so I know she carried a canteen, and she would often fill it up in streams, freshwater streams and springs. And the water was, certainly more pure in 1955. There's less development around the Appalachian Trail. So that's highly discouraged now, of course, but she drank fresh water, and occasionally she would, fill up her canteen at someone's outdoor spigot. So she was getting municipal water, purified water from a spigot that way. But great question. And I'm not sure I addressed the first one on the screen about why not wear a backpack. I don't know if I know the answer to that, except to say that, it might not have been within a reach. Those packs, even the steel frame outside external frame packs that like Earl Schaefer carried. I'm not sure she could afford that to begin with. And I'm not sure that would have been something that she would have found comfortable. There's no mention that she ever tried one of those on, or that anybody gave her that type of gear to play with. She just liked that bag that she could sling over her shoulder. I think it was comfortable for her. It balanced on her shoulder well. There's one experience. She climbed Mount Hood when she finished the Oregon Trail at Portland, Oregon. There's a local club that wanted to take her up Mount Hood for a climb up this beautiful high peak in the state of Oregon, not far from Portland. And they equipped her with all the cutting edge gear. They got her new hiking boots and rain gear, and they all took this hike together. And she made it about halfway up the mountain before she said, "I don't want to do this anymore." And she turned back around and left the club, the hikers, and came back to the bottom. And I have reason to believe that it was primarily she didn't like it because she was wearing all this new gear. It was the first time that she'd ever worn hiking boots, so far as I can tell. And I don't think she liked it. I think she was a simple person, wanted, canvas keds on her feet, a denim flexible bag on her shoulder. And that was about all, that was about all she needed. I've often thought I would, I should try to recreate a long hike using just the gear that she brought. I'm not sure if I'm brave enough to do it, but maybe I should put that on my list.
And we've had one other comment from the Flying Sprout, which for some reason not coming through, but basically saying, "Inspirational woman, fantastic story told, Ben. Great show. Thanks, Ben, Bob, and Rose." Well, I think that's pretty well it, everybody. Thank you very much for staying with us. It's been a long show, but I hope it's been an entertaining show and something a bit different for a Wednesday night here in very dull, miserable the UK, and hopefully pass some time for people over in the US as well. I just want to say thanks very much indeed to Ben. The links to his books in the UK and in the US are in the chat that Rose has put in there. And hopefully we will talk at a later stage when he has another book, which will be stimulating for outdoors people. So thanks very much indeed for your time, Ben. And I hope you have a good afternoon.
Thank you, Bob. And let me just invite anybody, if you're coming to hike in the U.S., drop me a line. You can find me on the internet. Drop me a line and let me know, and maybe I'll be out there. I'd love to meet, anybody who appreciates the outdoors. Just say hello.
That's awesome. And thanks very much indeed, Ben. Lovely. No problem at all. I look forward to it. Take care of yourself, Ben, and all the best.
Happy hiking.
And that is it. I hope you enjoyed this two-part series. The interview with Ben was really enjoyable and full of detail, and to be honest, we only scratched the surface of some of the fantastic stories and historical facts which can be found in his book. So I do recommend you dip into it at some stage. There is also a video documentary based on her life and with interviews with her daughters, and links to this can be found over on the show notes. If you're heading out on the Appalachian Trail and things get tough, I do hope you draw on your inner Grandma Gatewood and she pulls you through. Until next time, folks, take care out there and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.